make a big noise playing in the street. Gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Welcome back to Deep Thoughts. Today we're going to talk about competitiveness. And this comes as a user request from Matt. I want to thank you so much because I think it's a great idea. The concern that came to me, which I completely share, is that competitiveness, which is encouraged on all levels, on many levels, and we don't want to lose all parts of competitiveness, but competitiveness is sort of, in certain venues, can get completely and utterly out of control and really corrupt the minds of us and make us sort of the darker version of ourselves when dealing with other people. And so what I'm going to do, like I always do, is go at sort of the psychology of competitiveness, then get into maybe some of the perceived benefits of competitiveness, and then move into how maybe we could more actively manage good competitive natures and not get into a giant football fight, you know, the European football, soccer for Americans, where you see people just tear each other apart. It happens in America too, at baseball games and football games. Our football games where you hold it with your hands, which is really funny. Now, I want to start this off with an experience I had working at Electronic Arts. When I worked at Electronic Arts, like I've said a couple times, I worked really for all the VPs, including the CEO. And, you know, I was always bringing in big agendas. And so I built up this rapport with, you know, the top brass, and we'd do lunch all the time. And, you know, if we found each other in airports, we'd sit around talking for hours. And I got an idea, and I created 10 questions, which I'll have to review at a future time. But 10 questions I went around, and I scheduled, you know, real sit-down meetings in their office. And I said, you know, I want to ask you these 10 questions because you're all extremely successful. I have a tremendous amount of respect for you, and I would just love to know your impressions of these 10 questions. And I remember talking to one of my buddies, Bing Gordon, who was one of the early founders of EA. They give him crap because he wasn't technically a founder. He wasn't technically one of the first guys to walk in the door. There were 7 other people that really founded EA, but the thing that Bing always gets marginalized for is that he got in early, in the early 80s, and he stuck with the company for 20-plus years, 25, almost 30 years, before he actually moved on for other ventures. And so he's a huge contributing factor. And if you've met the guy, you'll know that he is a very youthful person. He understands kids, he understands gaming, and he's just an all-around great guy. And he hit me with an answer, and I can't remember exactly which question brought it out, because the question isn't about competitiveness. And I think it was just, I think I had a couple questions about, you know, dealing with how work interferes with family and how one deals with that and then gives kids good advice. You know, while you're not there because you're working so much, how do you make sure that your kids feel like you're always available if they really need you, and how you give them good advice, you know? And I think one of the things he jumped off in was sports, competitive sports. And, Bing is, you know, he doesn't exude, he's very competitive, but he doesn't exude any, like, ridiculous level of competitiveness, you know, that's unbalanced. Bing is probably one of the most centered guys I've ever met in my life. So coming from him was a big deal. And he essentially said that, you know, he pushed his kids through sports to make sure they had that competitive nature because, in his philosophy, which I think most of us agree with, you know, life is unforgiving in the competitive nature of life. You know, the whole thing about the survival of the fittest, sort of the low-hanging fruit, layman's definition of evolution, which has existed forever. And everyone's always understood it. Way before Darwin ever ripped it off from De Lamarck, everyone understood that the biggest guy in the village could beat you up and take your stuff, you know. So that's the fittest, you know, the physically the fittest, right? But when we civilized a little bit, we developed games, and games have rules, and you have to develop a skill set for those particular games, whether it be basketball, football, in a sports realm. And then there's academic competitiveness and perhaps creativity, sciences, that sort of thing. And it was very interesting because I'd never talked to anyone because my parents weren't huge into sports at all. Like, I didn't get stuck as a child watching any sports games whatsoever. You know, every once in a while I catch the World Series or the Super Bowl or something like that. And I always found, you know, if the teams were good and pitted against each other well, and, you know, there wasn't some ridiculous, destruction of Team A destroying Team B, you know, it was fun to watch. So it was kind of cool. But he was the first person to really put it down in black and white and say, this is an imperative as a parent that you somehow pass on the randomness of competitiveness. And so I've had about a decade and a half to think about his answer. And then so when Matt brought it up, I was like, yeah, we need to do something about that, because it's occurred to me to go in that direction a couple times during these deep thought constructions, you know. And so the idea would be, why would you continue watching this? You probably already understand a lot of factors of competitiveness. And I think that what I'm going to try to get at is sort of the healthy version of competitiveness, especially if you're a parent to a child, but even if you're just an adult or a young adult or whatever, and you're thinking, well, how do I deal with competitiveness? How far do I engage it before I don't want to lose my mind in competitiveness. Maybe you're a sports fan and you're way over the barrel. You know, you found yourself in a fight once because your team lost and some guy was disrespectful at a bar or at some stadium, and you found yourself wanting to kick somebody's ass, and then you came away from that and you're thinking, damn, I lost control. Like, why would I lose control? We're such a weird outside paradigm that has nothing to do with my life personally, you know? Now, tribalism is going to factor into the craziness, but we'll leave that towards the latter part of this episode. It is true. Life is massively competitive, but I think that the first, in my own personal experience, having I think I've had a really good run at competitiveness where, one, I definitely developed the skills. So when I needed to be competitive and I was interested in being competitive, because I'm not interested in being competitive in a lot of things that don't appeal to me, right? I don't memorize anything about sports. You know, I barely could name, you know, probably even a third of the baseball teams or any of the sports teams in any genre of sport in the United States. I just don't prioritize that in my life. And I'm glad that certain sports exist because I enjoy watching them every once in a while. I'm probably more of a baseball guy than anything, but I don't know anybody, you know. About the time I know someone's famous, they're doing their last couple games, and the reason why I know them is because they, you know, they're getting a lot of press because it's their last season or whatever. So I'm just not that guy. But in terms of creativity, I think that's where I love sort of a flavor of creativity or competitiveness, excuse me. But what I have found is the following, and you might find this valuable. You have an option in life when you want to do something really, really well in life. And there's all kinds of factors in that. You know, we talk about being creative in the episodes. We talk about perseverance, which is your personal struggle to accomplish anything, you know, in life. And so, what I want to say, you don't have to angle yourself inside your mind and motivate yourself by a sheer definition of competitiveness with someone perhaps you don't know or someone perhaps you do know. You know, for those of you in school, whether it be college or, you know, high school or below, I don't even know if I have any listeners in that area. I seriously doubt it, but you're surrounded by people constantly, and you're surrounded by a bunch of insecurities of people because they don't know who they are, right? Their id, their character, and their persona, they're just being controlled by it. You know, they have all these random emotions and feelings and concerns, and they feel weak at times, they feel strong at times, and it's just sort of almost like a garden sprinkler, you know, like you just randomly spraying everything everywhere, and they don't have control of themselves, which is why I make these episodes very specifically so that you have complete control over who you are, so that you're just in control. And when you have control, competitiveness takes a completely different tact, I think, than if you are sort of randomly, you know, flowing through the universe, almost like a leaf blowing in the wind. You know, the leaf doesn't have control over itself, you know. And we don't want to be that. We want to be like a glider, and we're riding it, and we're controlling it. You know, we want to turn left, right, go up, down. It's all your control. That's what I want for everybody, you know, because that way we get to see the destiny that's hiding inside you. And if you have an idea, you have a better chance of getting out of yourself. So this is going to be sort of a sort of anti-competitive replacement. You know, we're going to talk about competitiveness, but I'm going to try to usher into its place something that makes you much more relaxed and cool, and you know, with yourself, you know, you just feel centered, and help you get the same results and be extremely competitive, but do it in a nature such that you don't feel almost an unnecessary burn, an unnecessary negativity, because you're worried about competition out there. And I've got some great stories for you where I've neglected to let competition be a part of my life, and I've allowed it to be a serious motivator. But let me throw this at you. If you want to create something great, you know, you can play games with your mind. You know, I've talked about in the episodes in the past where I will reward myself with something I want to do after doing the thing I need to do. You know, so if I have a milestone at work, I program my house every once in a while. I'll do that thing for work, and then I'll reward myself with maybe a cigar outside, or I'll play a video game for a little while, or I'll do whatever, hang with friends. But I try, it doesn't always work. It's not a pure thing. I'm not like some, you know, perfect executor of my own ideas, but I'll play those games where I pitch things on the other side of what I want. Now, competitiveness is really driven, I think, at the idea that you have to really understand and engineer excellence within yourself as defined by those around you. So if you were to go play in a team of any kind, let's say it's baseball, and you want to be a good hitter, and you've got a certain field position, first base or whatever, you're going to have, in a hitting realm, you're going to have all of your teammates that can hit. And so there's going to be someone who's probably already good at it before you get there. And so you're going to need to compete against your own team member to get the preferable, you know, first string batter sort of thing. So you go up first. Then when you go out and take your team out and you play with other teams, then you're going to see that your batting is either good enough to win the game or not good enough. Your first base performances are going to either get people out or they're not going to get people out. And so you'll start to see, you know, there's this internal effect of, am I good enough to really consider myself a team player? Am I really valuable to the team? Which is kind of sort of an internal cycle of thought. And then there's this external cycle of thought, which is, am I performing for the team so that we can win as a team? So that's a very interesting, you know, duality of where you can place competitiveness. Again, tribalism comes in way later. Now, in my life, I've had a couple of really interesting experiences that I want to share just to show you where I was very acutely aware of the competitiveness around me. And I got lucky in school because, you know, I, like I've said before, I was an artist really early as a child. And there's only a couple artists I ever met in my lifetime, kids just on the block or whatever, that would come into my house. We'd all draw, and one kid would knock out something really, really cool. And I was like, ooh, boy, I don't know how to do that. Let me learn how to do that from him. And immediately the kid was, I remember, oh, this is silly, but I was probably about 12, and this kid drew a tooth, and he drew a hole in it. And he not only drew a hole in the tooth, but he drew sort of a 3D contour of the inside of the tooth, sort of like the cross section, like a cheese slice inside, and then the hole, you know. And it was brilliant that he must have seen that somewhere. And so then I started drawing the tooth with the hole in it, and he was angry that I copied him, which I think was weird. So there's this weird thing where people want to say, I want to be better than you and don't copy me. You know, don't ever get better than me. And I've dealt with that my whole life. But this kid, he got over it very quickly, but it was just interesting. He was so young, he was just telling me what his heart felt. You know, it was weird. When I got into drawing video games, it was sort of out of the blue. I mean, it was like literally 1 week I mean, my introduction into video games was that, or in professionally drawing them, professionally making money, which was about 19 when I started. I had drawn video games my whole life. As soon as I learned how to program a video game, I was like, I need art, and there's nobody else that knows how to do this. And we didn't have paint applications back in the day, so man, did you ever have to work hard to draw games in programming languages, right? But I went to work on a Tuesday working for the tech software people, got laid off, and then 3 days later, I'm working for this video game company. It was like out of thin air that this happened to me, and so I felt small. When I started working for this company, I'm working with at least three other artists who've been doing this for years. I mean, one guy had been doing it for almost a decade, and it was 89. So he had had a long stretch of drawing stuff and was very good at it. One kid had only been doing it for 2 or 3 years, but man, he was the best I've ever seen in my life drawing stuff by hand. I remember we didn't have 3D rendering applications to help us do anything. And so if you wanted to draw, you know, a unicorn running in 8 different directions with an attack sequence in 8 different directions, you had to draw it. I mean, it was like, there's the pixels on the screen. We used a product that I think Electronic Arts finally acquired called Deluxe Paint. And it was 600 by 400, I think, was the screen size at the time, a little 4:3 aspect ratio. And again, whatever we drew had to be drawn in such a way that the colors that we chose had to work for about 5 different color palettes. And so whatever color you picked, it had to punch through a bunch of different color palettes, almost like that 3D chess in Star Trek, right? So one square was red in this palette, was yellow in this palette, and some other version of 256 colors down below, and some other restrictive colors. And so it was daunting to get into this, and not only draw it photographically as much as we possibly could, but to make it work with all these different video cards, which only had a few colors in a lot of cases, right? Okay. So I was heads down, feeling very insignificant, but very excited and very confident that I could pull this off. But still, it was nerve-wracking, and the stuff I got assigned was pretty intense. You know, I did the company logo. I did three different video games for these guys. I was doing robots and futuristic San Francisco and just all kinds of weird stuff. Top-down views of cities, and then the little top-down, you know, animation of the characters. And I remember I came to work after I finished my first, what they call realm art. Realm was the world, and sprites were the characters. And so you had either a realm art assignment or you had a sprite assignment. And sprite was a little bit above me at the time, which I got into shortly after doing my first realm art. But what happened was I brought my work to the office within a month, because I was 12 hours a day, man. I was enjoying it, and I was in heaven, you know. Getting paid to be a video game artist in 89 was huge, right? And so I bring my work in, and the boss, we just happened to have a meeting where we flew in anyone from outside. The Activision heads were in town. They were the ones subsidizing our company, Aftershock Entertainment, which was actually Atomic Entertainment at the beginning. And then flew a couple of the artists in from out of town. And so I just brought my disc in. Here's my work. And they exhibitioned it in front of the other artists. And one of the guys who had been drawing a fairly simple city package, he was the guy with the most experience. I could tell he didn't quite have an eye for the details that I had had, and I don't know why. Just maybe I played more games than he did, or I was just more hungry at the time. But he put my artwork in the engine, and the engine was this beautiful scrolling engine, so you could scroll, man, like, damn, near 20 screens per second, 1989, which was insane, which is why the company exists in the first place. But he exhibitioned this to the whole team, as, hey, this is our new hot artist. Man, he just pounded this thing out. It's less than 30 days. He's finished with his first realm art. It looks fantastic. He dealt with a lot of aspect ratio problems because we had, like, skyscrapers that needed to go up, but everything was supposed to be slanted at a sort of an pseudo-isometric view. And I said, well, I got a problem here, because if I have a skyscraper going up, it's going to start drawing over the other areas of the city. And so we had to have a way to explain how they don't lean out, and so we made out of all the cities. It's in the future of San Francisco, so I started making all the buildings pyramids to explain that they were anti-earthquake buildings. Some crazy little patch to the theory. But anyway, he took this guy, he was really senior, and he threw my artwork in his face, like right in front of me, and it was me being pushed into almost a competitive conversation, and I'm an extremely empathetic person, and so I'm looking at this guy, and he's like, look, you know, you're still working on your realm art. It's half as complex as this thing this kid just finished, and he's done in a month, and you're now a month and a half into this thing, and you're asking for more time. Now, he didn't throw it in his face in a way that he was actually angry, but he sort of embarrassed me because now I'm the reason why this guy is being sized up. And so it was one of the very first times in my professional career where me doing something exceptional was made into a negative thing, because at my previous company, you know, if I stayed up all night and coded something or drew something, it was just, that was great that you did that, and they took it and they used it. It wasn't like they farmed my stuff out to other, or they didn't show my stuff to other employees and say, look, you know, you take a week to do something this kid does in a night, and what the hell, you know, you're wasting our money. Instead, it was a great, my previous job was a unbelievable age discrimination hub of the universe, where, again, I was doing something in one night that took people 15, 20 years older than me to do in a week, and their stuff was flawed, had all these bugs, and I never got really the accolades I needed or the money I should have received for my performance, but I soon corrected that. Another lesson for a different episode. But so that moment was weird, and I don't know if it made that guy do anything interesting, because I never saw the guy again. He continued working for the company, but I just never saw him again. The second thing that happened at that particular company was I continually turned in artwork very quickly, and the quality was really high. And there was a kid there, like I said, that was younger, and he looked like the lead singer from Faith No More. I remember just like this identical brother of that guy. And he was amazing. This guy was teaching me everything. And he just sat there in front of me and drew unicorn animations from scratch. Just like, well, you know, this is, if we're going to make him look like this, he starts drawing a horse. And if any of you have drawn a horse, it gets very, very tricky. And when you want to, when you have a very small square or rectangle to draw a sprite in, you know, to account for the horn going up, which is going to take a lot of your vertical space out, it was really tough. And this guy just drew it in 2 seconds. And he even gave me some templates for characters and said, you can draw on top of these and this will get you going. And I had a really tough assignment where I was doing Greek mythology. And so I had to do three-headed dogs. I had to do Medusa. That was my hardest one, where, you know, the swimming snakes on her head with a tail. And I just literally took her out of Clash of Titans. I rented the movie and just freeze-framed that stop animation character they did, and did that. But the kid, I turned those in, and he had to see that. And no one threw it in anyone's face this time. It was just, look at Mark's stuff. And we'd have these meetings where we'd review everyone's stuff and really just cheer everyone else on. It wasn't like that previous negative experience. But this kid, who was the pro, had sort of not turned in anything that was sort of amazing. And then I came in. I remember it was probably one of the last meetings we had before the company got split up due to Activision putting themselves on the block, which is kind of funny since they're the biggest company in the world right now for video games due to Blizzard Entertainment. He did a medieval castle realm art, and to this day, it is one of the most gorgeous things I've ever seen in my life. He did just, you know, it was all, again, leaned aspect ratio stuff. But he did, you know, just wood and stone and organic overgrowth and stuff. And I mean, it was just gorgeous. And when I looked at it, I could tell that he went home and worked extra hard on this. And it was damn near photographic. It was just fantastic. And so that was where I saw competitiveness turned into excellence. You know, it wasn't like this kid ever created anything ugly, but he really put a lot of effort into this thing. And I have to assume it was sort of due to a lot of the pressure of a lot of the other artists in the organization, including myself. So he blew us all away, and it was just fantastic. It was like that true competitive sort of good sportsmanship that you want in a company, that you want out of individuals. fast forwarding, I'll give you another one, because that's a person against person competitive nature, right? And I don't have them for you in the sports realm. When I was about 23, I started working consulting in the database industry while I was doing a bunch of other stuff as well. But I created my own company on the side, and I created a product that I've mentioned once before on the show, where when you have a ton of database engineers and they're all creating interfaces, right? Thousands of screens that you go through to do things. And if you've seen a point of sale system at a restaurant, you'll see them tapping on these screens really quickly. It's that kind of stuff, right? And I was doing a pretty extended contract at a pharmaceutical company, which is where I got a lot of my knowledge of pharma being very corrupt. And they had this standard that was very complex. They said, we want to make sure all the screens look like this. And they drew this screen that was really, really complex in terms of its coloring, its icon assignment, a lot of 3D grouting effects and that kind of stuff, using rectangles on top of each other. And it was sort of, it got to a point where if the engineer was supposed to get a bug-free application, just dressing up the windows was going to be a third of their job. And if they needed to change a screen, it became a nightmare to go in and move things around. So I got this bug up my butt. I said, you know what? I bet I can programmatically figure out all that stuff. Meaning, I can write a product where you load your module inside my product and you will have assigned how you want everything to look, where you want 3D effects to occur, what buttons should go in certain icons with certain verbs in them. So print buttons have little print icons in them. But at the same time, I wrote algorithms that figured out alignment. So if you have a field label here and a field and a bunch of them down in a line because you've just dropped them on the screen, this is before apps helped you snap them into place, right? I would sense which ones belong to which, and I would snap them certain distances from each other, align them all, make sure they all have the right fonts, everything, right? Thousands of settings you could put in this thing. So I wrote this product over about 8 months at home, and then eventually just immediately sold it to the pharmaceutical company and a bunch of other Fortune 1000 companies and made some money off of it, right, for a few years. And eventually ended because the company that wrote the product that I wrote mine in damaged their product such that I couldn't figure out what color anything was on the screen. They actually reverted back and screwed it up because they allowed a guy that knew nothing about programming to be the product manager and just totally effed up the product. It's really sad. But the reason why I mentioned that is the following. When I started writing that product, I shared it with a couple of the heads of state in that programming product. And, you know, I was probably in the top 10, if not higher, engineers in this product. I knew how to use it better than anyone else on planet Earth. And because I worked for the company that wrote the product, and I was one of their top, at the time, tech support guys, so I learned just by trial, or I should say baptism through fire, taking phone calls from all these different companies, from Los Alamos Labs to all these private engineers, trying to make the product do things that they that the product wasn't designed to, and they were succeeding. And so I saw all this impossibility being accomplished constantly. And I thought, well, when I want to do my thing, which no one's ever done before, it's going to be useful, and I know it's possible. But here's what happened. The reason why I mentioned this is a competitive thing that I want you to learn big time. And I've mentioned it once before, but we're right on the subject, so I'm going to throw it back out again in a more focused, elaborated fashion, right? I had a bunch of people around me saying, oh, well, you know what? This company and that company, they're already creating that thing that you're going to create. And you shouldn't do it. They're trying to shoot me down. And not for any very specific reason. They just thought, hey, you're wasting your time. You're going to come out with your product. And there's going to be two competitors that's going to blow you away. All right. That's competitiveness sort of out of thin air. And what I did was say, screw those guys. They're not better than me. I'm going to do it the Steve Jobs way. I'm going to do it the perfect way, the easy way, with the greatest interface, the best design, fewest clicks, most features, and it's going to be built for a Fortune 1000 pharma company. So I know if I can satisfy those guys with over 300 developers and probably 10,000 screens, I can beat any of those competitors. And what happened? I was the only one to finish the product. There were no competitors. Now, what if I had listened to all that chatter? What if I had listened to all of that naysaying, as Jack Black would say? I wouldn't have finished my product. I would have quit. I would have then later found out that no one created their product, and I would have been suffered the regret of not doing it, but instead I did it. And the amount of business it taught me was unbelievable. I had to write my own manual, and I had to get it duplicated at the print place. I had to do my own master, gold masters, and it was back in the floppy days, so I had to do my own masters, do my own labels, form a company. You know, it was internet, was brand new, so I had to buy an email address, I think for $50 a month from Netcom, some company in the Bay Area. No websites, right? And so I sold this product. Now, the interesting thing was, again, the competitive takeaway is don't let somebody say, just because someone else is fabled to be doing this, that you should stop what you're doing. You're going to do it different and most likely better for some people, at least. Let's just say two artists are going to paint Marilyn Monroe. Well, you're a different artist, you know? And if you're both going off a photograph and you're supposed to duplicate it as photographically identical, well, maybe you are going to sort of, on one level, compete directly with the person. If you both do an excellent job, you may not even be able to tell the difference between the painting unless you're able to go off in sort of a Picasso mode and do your own cubism version of it, or pick any photograph you want and maybe pick a better photograph at Marilyn. The moral of that story is don't let anyone naysay you out of your goal. Just make sure that what you do is highly, highly competitive within yourself, right? Consequently, when I finished that product, I started, because I left the company that made the product, I did my product in, then I came back and I started doing conferences where I was one of the lead developers in the company, and I would stand in front, I would do presentations to these giant rooms, like 600 people, standing room only, showing them the new technology I created for the internet when that finally arrived. And I would get done, I'd walk off stage, I'm like 26 years old, which for me was a professional age, and in today's age, you're lucky if you pay your own bills at 26, right? But I walk off the stage, and these people would rush me, and I would think, you're going to ask me about the internet technology because I just showed you a web server I wrote, an FTP application, an email application, all this other stuff, and no one had ever seen those things before. But they wanted to talk to me about my product called GUI Designer. They were like, oh, you made that product. I used that product. Oh, man, it saved my life and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, wow, no one's interested in what I just talked about. They're interested in this product I wrote, which I can't sell anymore because the product got upgraded to not work anymore. It's really weird. That can be you. You can succeed in the accolades of your ability as long as you just don't let anybody naysay you out of your dream, you know? And there's more to competitiveness. We're going to go back into the global benefit of being competitive to your psyche. But I want to also, peel off the tribalism before we get there, or when we get there. I want to encourage you with those two examples I just gave you to do the following. Do things for you. Don't worry about anybody else. If you're going to play in a sport, don't become the best hitter or the best goalie or the best whatever because anyone else wants you to be the best. Do it because you want to be the best, you know? One of the things that feeds into that, before we move on, is your sense of perfectionism. And so I have a really silly thing that got me to believe I was a perfectionist. And I actually was a crappy perfectionist, to be honest. For the first 20 years of my life, maybe even add a few years at the end, I wasn't a very good perfectionist. Meaning I wasn't, bare minimum guy by any stretch. I definitely pushed things up and I loved details and stuff. So when I painted something, I would go in there and knock out certain details and stuff. But I didn't go back into what I was doing to add more perfection, more polish, more amazingness, more depth, more metaphor, more imagery systems, right? And now when I write scripts, I am about every single word. I'm about the velocity of the word being read off the paper. I'm about the visual impression of what I'm doing. I'm about the on-point plot that I need to push to the reader and the subtextual meanings of everything, such that you read my script and you'll tell someone, oh, this person has all this backstory, and then you read the script and you're like, well, where's the backstory? And you're like, well, you got it, right? You still got the backstory from what's being said. And they're like, yeah, but it's not in there. It's like, yeah, because everything is so beautifully encoded in the text, in the prose, the speaking part, the dialogue, that you get it. You get that someone has a particular past that feeds into the dimension of the character, right? You can do that with whatever you do, and you can make it better and better and better. The problem with perfectionism, let me finish my story first. The reason why I got this weird infusion that I was a perfectionist was that I'm a Virgo. And if you ever read a Virgo bio on some, you know, whatever the astrology that's there, they always put in Virgo, usually, Virgo definitions that were extreme perfectionists and extremely creative. And so hearing that reinforced in me, besides what I said in the previous episode, that my family was very creative as well and scientific. And so it was always like your aunt, your uncle, they're that way too. So obviously you are, you know, obviously there's gene patterns in me that belong to the family. And so we have that. But, you know, I took it further than most of my family members. And so, it just happened. But perfectionism came very, very slow. And, you know, I've mentored kids now. I mentor at least a couple kids under 13. And I realize that the attention span problem that we have today is actually really competing with perfectionism, and it really goes, and we suffer as adults too. So, you know, again, if I convince you to do this on your own, the second lesson you have to take with that advice, if you're going to take that advice from me, to compete on your own without the need to beat somebody else, right? If I guarantee you, if you go practice to hit a baseball or a softball with a bat, and you're in a batting cage, and you hit every ball that comes down the pike, right? Every ball that's thrown at you by a machine or a human being, and you know how to pop it, you know how to ground ball it, you know how to bunt it, whatever. It won't matter how good the other team is. You know, you'll be a deadly weapon in whatever you do, you know? But the attention span governs anything, right? So if I said to you, draw a picture for 5 minutes, even if you're amazing, it only goes up to a certain level of perfectionism. I said, now draw the same thing and take an hour, well, there's a hell of a lot more than 5 minutes, right? And then I say, now take a day, take a week, take a month, visit it over the course of your lifetime and just keep making it better and better and better. You know, mathematically, you're going to get a much better product out of yourself, hopefully, right? That's sort of what I want you guys to incubate and look at within yourself when it comes to your own personal competitiveness. You know, and again, I would say that some of the best thing you can do is to reel it inside and outside the paradigm of others dictating how you behave. It shouldn't matter what anyone else thinks of you. You be the best, and you know how to be the best. But get advice. Read if you got to read to do it. Try it out. Don't beat yourself up if you don't get it to that level right away. You know, they say practice makes perfect, and the problem is that sounds like a goofy little kid saying, but it's the magic to life when it comes to competitiveness. Okay. Now let's go into the tribalism competitiveness, which is where it gets out of control. And this is really the thrust of why our listener wanted to really get into this, because it is a destructive force. And any one of you that have seen the news or YouTube videos where people die because they're at a game, maybe they're not even that competitive, but they're just stuck in a brawl. They're stuck in the one I've seen a lot, which is really horrid, is European soccer games / football games, where a team loses and you have a bunch of spectators all over the stadium, and everyone rushes down to the field to express their discontent, maybe beat up the players, chase somebody around, and you get people that are trampled on, people are pushed against fences, and they simply get crushed to death. Then you have the people that simply fight, and of course there's a lot of alcohol being sold at these events, and so people aren't having the best day of their lives. We had a horrific situation where at Dodger Stadium, San Francisco Giants fan showed up and wore a Giants shirt, and an L.A. Dodger thug, and a couple guys, actually, I don't even know if they ever caught these guys. They beat him to death in the parking lot. I think even with a baseball bat or something, it was horrible. Killed the guy. Ridiculous. And a human being was removed out of the world because of an ancillary thing that happened in their life, which is two teams playing, you know? You know, one thing that always blows my mind about loyalism to teams is that, you know, in Los Angeles, you know, we used to have the Raiders down here in Los Angeles, and which I guess they're back now, I guess. But, you know, the idea is that this is your bloodline playing against someone else's bloodline, right? St. Louis Cardinals come in to play the Dodgers, and it's St. Louis DNA against L.A. DNA. And, of course, this, depending on how much one's evolved their minds, they go back to that tribalism of it's us against them. When half, if not more, than half of the players are from Cuba, from all over the country. You know, it's the kid from South Carolina that goes to play for the Dodgers. He's an amazing hitter. It's the kid from Cuba who comes up and he's the most amazing pitcher. These teams aren't made of any of the local tribe people in, you know, in LA, Criminy. We're like we are a nomadic society built out of people with dreams. You know, and some people are native to here, but native only goes back a few generations before you're from someplace else. Even if you're from Mexico, you're from someplace else. But people get this competitive nature. But when we talk about sports, the competitiveness and the anger and the hostility that comes out is much more fundamental and almost goes back to Kenneth Burke's scapegoat society theories, where societies will scapegoat other societies and groups will scapegoat other groups, or a group will scapegoat a single individual and say, we lost because of you, or my life is bad because of you, or something like that, right? I would assume that the day that the Giants fan got murdered in the Dodger Stadium parking lot, I don't know the score that day, but I'm going to guess that the Giants won. And that left the Dodger people feeling inferior, because they've identified themselves with this entity that's just a logo on paper made of people from all over the world, and they identified themselves with that. And so when they walked out, they valued their life based on the loss or win of their team, because inside they don't have anything else in their life to value their life from. Now, Titus Flavius, I've mentioned a couple times on the show, is the Caesar that invented the Colosseum. If you look up Titus Flavius or the Colosseum, you'll see the definition mentioned in both of their accounts. Okay. Now, he's the first one to formalize it, but I'm sure this happened for thousands of years prior to his participation. But what he learned was that the Colosseum, which the Colosseum is almost a social apparatus, more than a political apparatus and a distraction mechanism, metaphor for life. It's not just a building where they played sports in and, you know, kill people in with lions and stuff and gladiators and all this other stuff. It is the construct by which a political party back in the day would satiate the people to focus on something other than what was going on in their world. Sort of how the TMZs of the world make us focus on celebrity worship while the politicians do everything they can to steal sovereignty and put money in their pocket. Tabloid news is the new Colosseum. Sports is the old Colosseum. And both of them are doing what they are supposed to do, which is distract the people. So when we talk about sports getting completely out of control, we're back to the algorithm of the Colosseum. We have sort of primitive brains in human beings, and this, there's no other way to say it, primitive humans. And I don't care how rich you are, how smart you are, the level of brilliant rich people that I know that are still uber tribalists and attached to sports names and who actually go through anxiety. Some people have to take drugs to calm down. Some people have to go have bar fights to calm down, right? Because they've essentially outsourced the value of themselves and the identity of themselves to the sport, to whatever it is that they worship. Remember the guy that cried in his selfie video about people giving Britney Spears a bunch of crap, right? This guy actually sat at home, cried into his Apple Watch about how, you know, Britney Spears was being roughed up by the world. Obviously, had no idea of how utterly, you know, self-induced any of Britney's conditions are, you know, right? When it comes to sports, it's unbelievable to me that people actually believe that their team is going to win every year. That's sort of what it works out to be, right? When you have a playoff and you have a league that goes into a championship, the interesting mathematics about it is that every team loses but one in the end. And yet each one of the local regions in America believes that their team is the best out of pure, ridiculous indoctrination and out of having no other thing in their life to value other than an external object or entity known as a team. That's why we can't do that. That's why we have to have complete sovereignty within ourselves. You know, when I talked to my daughter when she was really young, I said to her, I said, you know, at this point in your life, you know, I was projecting out on a timeline. I said, you're going to get into boys and it'll be a little bit different than you are now. They're all cooties, you know, objects now, but later on you're going to be attracted to them. And I said, look, I said, boys are dumber than girls. It just is the truth. They don't develop very quickly and they're going to be a couple of years behind you at a minimum socially. They don't feel like you feel. They're not, I didn't really say empathy or sympathy, but I explained to her, you know, they won't worry about how you feel about anything. They're just going to worry about what they want. And I said, it's important throughout your entire life that you don't outsource the opinion of yourself to a boy, because in almost under almost every circumstance, the boy is not going to have the intellectual prowess to actually have a certifiable, decent definition of you in the first place. So why would you let a boy determine whether or not you're pretty? Why would you let a boy determine whether or not you're smart or interesting or whatever? And that advice worked out pretty well. The same thing goes for tribalism. When a society is repressed and they are unhappy, Kenneth Burke's theory of scapegoating starts to pop out. A person wakes up and says, why am I so unhappy? Why do I have so much regret? Why do I have so much frustration in my life? When that occurs, we, like I've said many times, the brain doesn't want to feel pain. And so when you divert those feelings internally, because that's the cause of the situation, it's really just the perception of yourself lacking. You know, I'm hoping that anyone who feels that way will go back and listen to every single Deep Thoughts. And I can almost guarantee you, if you listen to it and you put it into practice, you will have that reinforced belief in yourself and mechanisms, very black and white mechanisms, to make sure you forge your own opinion of yourself and own it, right? And at least if you're confused, you know the apparatus that you need to deal with to make it happen, right? Like I always say, self, family, work. You work out those three hemispheres, at least get two out of three correct on any one day, and you're not going to need scapegoating to survive to bedtime, you know? But as soon as the economy's bad, as soon as war starts to kill off all of our brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and children, it becomes almost an irreversible, in our perception, negative arc that is our life. Our story just becomes this, you know, life's a bitch and then you die sort of, you know, catchphrase, which is unfortunate. So it is up to us, all right, to reel in this tribalism. Now, I'm going to say this to some of you, and you're going to go, yeah, man, you know, I don't do that. And this is all just a big affirmation of how you live your life. Some of you, probably very few of you, will find yourself actually participating in those moments and realize, oh, yeah, it is right. I don't like myself or my life right now, and so I'm lashing out at others to try and explain why my life is bad. So again, I'm kind of preaching to the choir almost at all times with Deep Thoughts, folks, and maybe just a kernel of knowledge. And I almost perceive this as you know this, but maybe the only value I'm bringing to you is putting methods in your vocabulary, in your vernacular, in your mechanism of explaining it to someone else, so that you can maybe educate better if you haven't thought of what I think of, you know. And again, you guys educate us every single day as well. And part of this has to do with the, You know, if we're going to fix the world, you can't fix it from the symptom to the cause. We always have to go from the cause to the symptom. And you know this already, but think about it. If you keep turning on the television every day and there's a new riot in some sports stadium and a bunch of people die, you know that even if you could walk in the center of the stadium and grab a mic and go, "Hey, everybody, listen here, you know, we have to get along." It's never going to work like that, right? Everyone's going to just attack you because you're another part of the problem. So we have to, you know, deep thoughts is all about going at the bowels of psychology in man, and it feeds sociology, right? If we as individuals change, we change the larger algorithm of the social interaction between us. That's why it's important that we learn this information, you know, we pass it around. You guys give me ideas for things. But I want to tell you a personal scapegoating, not personal to me, but like a more psychological scapegoating theory that feeds into a social scapegoating theory. Now, I'm going to say this, but we actually have some tribal problems in Europe right now with the invasion of the uncertified Muslim immigrants that are trying to rape Europe. So I'm going to say this, and I know that you actually have that on the tip of your mind if you're in Europe, and so it's not going to quite... this really doesn't apply to that invasion. You know, a million refugees per country per year is crazy. It's got to be shut down. You got to shut your borders off. You got to haul those people out of your country, incarcerate all these people, raping people, all this kind of stuff. So forget them. I'm going to go back to the Midwest, in the United States of America. I grew up in Kansas, and in Kansas, what was really interesting about my small little town was that we had all races represented, and you know, we had Mexican families, black families, and white families. We really didn't have the Asian contingency much, although there'd be one family that ran like an Asian restaurant down the street, and it was always like the most popular place. I never saw an Indian person, never saw an Arab person, just because they just don't frequent that area, right? But everyone's tend to get along, and you know, you'd find a racist person every once in a while in the town, but they were just fossils, you know? So people really got along with each other. And these families were famous, you know, like these various families and of different races from the white race. You know, it's just the way it is. We were probably 95% white. They always had something about their family that was revered. You know, they were some of the best teachers. If they owned restaurants, in fact, the Mexicans in our town were almost royalty because they had the best food in our entire town. And it was like, if you had the extra money to take your family to dinner, you always went to either the Mexican families. And just prior to that, we had the Williamson family in my hometown, which made probably one of the best barbecue places, probably without a doubt, the best barbecue I've ever eaten in my life. But they eventually retired and closed their place down, unfortunately, and their sauce is gone, right? Really super sad. But they went out on top. That's the cool thing, right? And later I found out they all lived into their 90s, and I could have driven 8 miles away from my hometown and probably solicited out a jar of their sauce. And I only found out as I read the obituaries and then wrote an editorial in the newspaper about them. But here's why I mentioned this. I had family members of mine who grew up in this little town of mine. And consequently, if you launch Google Earth on a Macintosh computer or an iOS device, and I think when you just launched the product for the very first time, the guy who did that came from my hometown and was a couple of years ahead of me, which I never met the guy, and his last name's Webb, which is kind of funny. He centered the product so it goes straight to my hometown. So my hometown's nowhere. It's 100 miles from every major city, but if you launch Google Earth on an Apple device, it goes straight to Chanute, Kansas, which is really funny. And we've painted in the center of the town, Main Street, and I think Lincoln, a Google map, and Google actually donated several $1,000s to it. And so it's just a bizarre little thing. That's just a little footnote for you. But I had family members of mine, very close family members, move to Texas. And this is not a slight on Texas whatsoever. It's actually just a pure slight on my family members. But the two individuals that moved down south to Texas, they had, you know, image issues, self-image issues, and they did not like the way that they turned out in life. One of them got really obese, and one of them just cannot deal with looking in the mirror. He is a odd dude. One of them I haven't talked to for 5 or 6 years, and if I die and never talk to the guy, it'll be a great day. One of them is close enough. I talk to him all the time. But they went from Chanute, my little town, to the Dallas area. And within a year, the N-word started coming out a lot. And just to preface this, which is why it's a little confusing to me until I figured it out, which has to do with this competitive tribalism thing, on a more subatomic level of humanity, the N-word was used in my family quite a bit, which may shock you, may not shock you, but here's the caveat. It was never, ever used towards a black person. It was never used in the context of referencing a black person. It was actually, and this is before gangster rap ever started using it, and classic rap never used that word ever. It was an endearing phrase to each other because our respect for the black culture was high, super high. A lot of my family members realized that the black males really preserve manhood in a really cool way. As the whites were trying to just farm it off to, you know, these soy boy replacements in Hollywood for superheroes, the blacks hung on to it and were always the coolest guys on the planet, dressed the best, had a strut when they walked, made some of the best funky music in the world. And so when we would greet each other, we felt like it was almost an accolade of we're not corny white people who can't hold beats. We listen to Al Green, Earth, Wind, and Fire, the Commodores, all that stuff, right? The Temptations, everything. Stevie Wonder, all that. And we were almost, patting ourselves on the back that we were up at their level. And that's how the N-word was ever used in my household. Never derogatory, ever. In fact, if my dad was able to bring home one of his buddies who was black, it's like a cool day. That might sound pathetic, but that's just the way it was. You know, they were unique. They were unique in the Midwest, and it was sort of just an interesting cultural thing. In that barbecue family I talked about, they were royalty in our family. People would drive 350 miles to eat at our town, and then spend the night, eat again, and then go home with a whole carload of this food, right? I mean, that might sound silly, but, yeah, that's the truth. So when some of my family, you know, broke off and moved down south, and then the N-word started coming out in full context and very derogatory, just the way that you don't use it, all right? I moved to California, and so I moved into a world where I was meeting even more races and becoming more acclimated, and I ate Indian food for the first time, I ate Japanese sushi for the first time, I ate probably more authentic Chinese food and Mexican food. For me, I was in a cultural pool of just elation. I moved up into Ventura County, and they have a little town over there called Oxnard, just below Ventura, which is sort of where you have probably your most, other than East LA, your most indigenous Mexican families, and it's their town. And, you know, when you ever watch those videos of, like, Snoop Dogg with the slammed, you know, 60s cars, convertibles that have been all detailed up, those come out of Oxnard, and those brothers know what they're doing, right? Suicidal Tendencies lived one block from my house, you know, a bunch of the band members, so I was a huge fan of theirs, and it was just cool. And so when my family starts calling in slowly over this next decade using derogatory terms, I couldn't figure it out. I was like, what's going on? Does Texas make you racist? Like, what's going on, right? And I go back to visit, and every once in a while I bounce through Texas, which I don't like to bounce through it, not because I don't like Texas, because I don't like the family members and the way they behave in that area, or at least I don't like the way they behave in that area. If I can drag them out of that area and get them to more neutral zones, that doesn't come out of their mouth. It's really strange, right? And what I figured out was that they don't. And this feeds into the tribalism that goes into the stadiums, which causes the riots, right? That whole scapegoating thing. My family members, the couple that moved there, don't like what has turned out to be their lives. They don't like what they look like in the mirror. They don't like what they've accomplished in life. And so they started scapegoating anything they could. And in their recessed minds, all right, they started going in a racial route. They could have gone in any route they wanted to, but they went in a racial route and picked out of nowhere, probably a race that has so little to do with them, it's crazy. you know. And, you know, they would try to legitimize it by saying, well, that guy, you know, didn't work as hard as he could have worked. And I'm sitting there looking at my family members like, are you some exception to that rule? Really? You go home and sit on your ass. You have all the time in the world to do everything and you do nothing. You know, I'm working a full-time job and I'm writing films and I'm doing shows and all this other stuff. Don't tell me you don't have time to do stuff, right? I had a kid at the time, you know, and it was like, cry me a freaking river, right? But they lashed out in a tribalistic way. And that was sort of on a competitive nature that they thought they were out competing these individuals, but these individuals were, you know, they were keeping their jobs while my family members were having to jump from job to job or getting laid off. When we go back into the stadium, the Titus Flavius Stadium, and we see these huge competitive brawls, these people hate what they've turned out to be. And they've usurped this thing that in their mind is bigger than them, which is the Raiders, the Dodgers, the Angels, whatever team is in your local area, right? And they say, I only succeed if that team succeeds. And that's a kiss of death, man. You know? People ask me, well, who's your favorite team in baseball? Because I'll tell them I love baseball. And I'm like, you don't understand. I'm not telling you I like the Yankees. I'm not telling you I like the Dodgers. I'm telling you I love baseball. I love any baseball game, and I don't care if it's little league kids playing or the Yankees playing the Dodgers in the World Series. I don't care. Is there competitiveness? Is the chess game of this slow, methodical, brilliant strategery game being played that I can watch? You know? The fakes, the bluffs, the bunts, the, you know, all this, you know, let a guy walk, you know, and, you know, I mean, just brilliant, you know, because I don't engage in the tribalism. I'm not trying to put myself up on some pedestal. Everyone else is bad. I'm good. It's just the way I approach it. And I'm just lucky because I'm a nerd, right? I played football in high school and junior high. But I stopped growing at one point, like I've said in the past. And I figured, well, you know, I'm going to save my hands for other things, right? And I sort of regret not playing all the way through high school, but only because of things I've learned as an adult. Competitiveness. If you take it up to a really macro level, some really high altitude level, and we start to look at what's happening to Europe, we have Germany, very interesting country when it comes to competitiveness. There are few people on earth that buy a German-made vehicle or a German-made product and mourn the fact that it's so amazing. I don't think that happens very often. Maybe never, right? And that's the friendly competition that comes out of Germany. Germany, you know, was essentially the bedrock of the Prussian education system, which predominantly influenced the left brain over the right brain. The Nazis benefited from left brain focus. You know, it was very myopically focused towards whatever the hell they were trying to do, and they did it. And they did it so extremely well that even as we look back in history and we say, oh my God, these guys were horrible. You know, the worst massacre in history, which they aren't responsible for the worst ones in history, but they did a very good version of their own. It's on the other side, the mechanical side of things, we're like, damn, they had the best guns, the best uniforms, the best tanks, the best planes. And the only way we actually beat them was to overwhelm them with sort of almost as good a stuff as theirs. You know, we got the Tommy gun going. We got the, you know, the Mustang and, you know, a few other mechanisms. Our Navy eventually figured out how to get rid of the U-boats, you know. But it was tough, man. It was super duper tough. And do you think the Nazis cared if anybody was better than them? Nah, they just did it. They just made the best that they could make, and they had the engineering background to do it. I hate mentioning that, but I just thought that's one we can all sort of agree on. It's like, damn, yeah, they were pretty good. And then, you know, because they were so good, the British and the Americans got together and pushed the envelope of what we could do mechanically to stop these guys. And there's a competitiveness that is a necessity of life. And I think that you're seeing a new version of this in Europe when it comes to the infiltration of the Middle East into Europe. And crazy, crazy psychopaths like George Soros trying to orchestrate it through guilt-tripping the policies in Europe. But I tell you what, right now, people are pushing back. You know, I just posted a video on our Facebook page, which if you see this a long time from now, it's not going to be there, but it was a French politician basically taking their politicians to task and saying, you're loyal to this thing called the EU, and you're not loyal to France. Screw you, which I think is interesting. So what is the balance? What is the balance to competitive nature? Because kids definitely need to learn that life is going to be unforgiving. And that's why I always say that to parents that are over-coddling their kids, it doesn't work. We can look at the baby boomers of this world and look at their absolute Bernie Sanders social tit-sucking that you know, Bernie's a baby boomer. Bernie, of course, believes in socialism. Like some people in my family are baby boomers, and they just want the free payday. They don't care if their grandchildren have to pay the bill. They don't care. They're out for themselves because they're weak. They're weak-minded. They're non-empathetic because they're largely left-brain. And they just don't care. So what's the balance? I'm going to divert back to the beginning of the episode, which is it needs to reside within you. It needs to be something that you want to do for yourself, and not something you need to do to prove anything to anyone. That's my advice to you. What's nice about that is that you can work completely by yourself, being your only critic, and really subtract out of your life the perils of disappointment. You know? Taking it back into sports. So let's marry the front of this episode with the back of the episode, and let's take it back into sports, which is where a lot of the concern comes from. It's not the only place, but it's just one we can all understand, one place we can all get on the same page, right? What if I told you the best thing you can do, at least stage one, the very best thing you can do if you're a sports fan is to not pick a favorite team? What if you can do that? That's the first stage you might be able to pull off. It's just say, I no longer have a favorite team. What I love is the sport itself. And I'll tell you this. The cool thing is I don't get disappointed watching baseball. I can be in anywhere in the world at any time of day. And if baseball comes on the restaurant monitor, I'm in heaven watching baseball. And I don't care in the slightest who's up there playing. What I might do is root for the underdog if it's a close score, just to make it a great game, because I want to see great baseball. If a team behind can get ahead of the team that's ahead, well, something great happened in the game. Who cares who it is, right? That's how I operate. But I'm lucky, and I didn't get indoctrinated into sports. Second tier up might be, all right, you're going to pick your favorite team or keep your favorite team. But like I said, you're going to realize the statistics of nature. In a competitive playoff, all teams lose but one. So your desire for your team to win is tempered by your understanding of statistics. That if there's 330 million people in America, even the babies, and they all had a way to figure out which team was their favorite team, that every single region in this country loses but one. And you know, maybe there's a transplant from LA that went to New York and he still goes for the Dodgers. But overall, only one region of the world wins, especially in an international soccer/football competition. So maybe that's a way you can get in, still have a team, and not die over it. A little caveat to that second tier would be to understand deeply that your team is not made of natives. Almost no team is made of the native citizens of your region. So the only thing that you're really rooting for is the jersey, the logo, winning. That's all you could possibly be rooting for. Some people might get into the financials and say, well, I want the World Series to be in my hometown because we make, you know, billions of dollars off that revenue. And I think there's probably a few people who care on that level. And that would make a little more sense to me. The loss, right? But a blanket theory on top of this whole episode might be the following. You don't want to feel negative. Like I said in an essay, and I've said this in articles as well, part of your health regimen of life is not to feel negativity. And for those individuals that watch sports and get to the level that they're drinking because their team isn't winning, or they're drinking because they're having a good time, then they drink more because their team is losing, and then they see someone gloat, which is obviously a separate violation of humanity, and they feel like they got to beat the guy up, kill him, because he's just, you know, gloating is a total lack of empathy, right? You know, it should be like, hey, buddy, don't worry, man, you guys will win the next time, or that was a great game, you know, and I you know, like, if so, let's just say I'm not a fan of anything in particular, but let's just say I'm a Yankees fan, I happen to go to the Dodgers, and the Yankees win, and I'm sitting next to a buddy who's way more into sports than me, I'd say, look, man, that was a great game. Your guys were amazing. And someone had to win, and it just went our way this time. You know, some tact like that. And, of course, it would be like trying to tell Neanderthal that's the way you should think. But it's not going to – again, we're not going to fix it from the septum down. We're going to fix it from the bottom up. And all we can do is fix ourselves, right? But there is a very intense theory of cancer that relates to epigenetics. And again, just for a review, epigenetics is the real scientific theory of evolution, which is that not only is the survival of the fittest, and Darwinism's crap, but it's your environment affects you. You know, I got some cool air blowing on my skin right now. Well, that's affecting all my epidermal, you know, intakes in terms of what my body needs to do state-wise to balance out the season that's changing. But because everything's electrical in your body and thoughts are electric, you can't walk around under any circumstance. Forget competition just being the only limiter to this theory. But we can't get into situations where we feel like we're dying. And when you feel like you're losing in some profound way that you need to go out and beat somebody up, you feel like you're dying. And you can't afford to feel like that, because the second you do, your neuropeptides in your brain, which are, again, stem cell peptides, they form based on the thoughts that you're having. And they feed the evolution of your body based on how they develop. But at the same time, just thinking a certain negative thought, people who think they have cancer, people think they're not going to recover from cancer, they typically don't. Those that think they're taking a drug that will help them, whether it helps them or not, you know, the whole placebo thing, they tend to do better. People who sit in hot springs to heal, they believe the water is healing them, and it actually does in very scientific ways, but maybe not explicitly going after their lymph node cancer. It's just that the frequency of their body is centered, their happiness goes up, and their immune system benefits from that combination, and they survive, right? When we look at the gang mentality, the mob mentality that goes into sports and leaves sports, and this happens at concerts, this happens at all kinds of stuff, but usually when it's a head-to-head sort of circumstance, you may want to divorce yourself from that regimen. You know, I would hate to hear that any of our listeners who are hip to all this went to some game somewhere and got beat up, or even worse, got killed because some caveman coming in with, you know, a lack of understanding, lost his shit, and hurt everybody. It'd be really sad, you know? In terms of your children, I would pass on the first part of the episode, which is help them understand that greatness comes out of dedication, and greatness typically comes out of a certain finite amount of time being invested, which is a longer amount of time than a shorter amount of time. You know, Jeff Bridges, I'll give you a really great example. The Bridges family in general, you know, are all actors. But when their children and grandchildren were interested in becoming actors, there's a story that Jeff told. And in fact, I think Jeff told this about himself because his father was an actor. But regardless, the family regimen to teach acting is the following. They say, okay, I want you to come in. I want you to go outside this room, go into the next room so I can't see you. I want you to rush in this room and pretend like it's Christmas, and the Christmas tree is in that room, and you just opened your favorite present, and I want you to come in the room and behave like you got the best present in the world. All right. So the kids run around the corner, and they come in. Oh, Daddy, oh, my gosh, Grandpa, I got this thing. Oh, it's amazing. And he's like, that was great. Now go on the back in that room and do it again. And do it again. And do it again. And he teaches them how a movie's made. It's very, very interesting. That's one way that we can teach our kids about competitiveness. Have them draw a picture or do whatever it is they love to do. And then say, awesome. Now do it again. And make it better this time. Maybe even tell them ahead of time, you're going to do it again. Again, the whole, what I do with kids is to say, you know, I give them little tests. I'll say, we're going to do this for 5 minutes. We're going to do this for 10. We're going to do this for an hour. And then they just get to see. And then I will do something around them. Last year, I painted these birdhouses. And we made them little, we bought a bunch of like blank wood birdhouses. And we got a bunch of paint, a bunch of glitter, and a bunch of stickers, and all kinds of stuff. And I had a little 8-year-old next to me helping. So I had her do the bulk colors, you know, and then I would take them and I put down, you know, snow drifts on them and all kinds of 3D contours. And I weathered it so it looked really old and did all the detail and flicked the brush to make it look like it had snow on it. And she got to see that. And so at first she wanted to be done in 5 minutes, you know, figuratively speaking. But as she started seeing me put house after house up at night, it was almost like Christmas every day because she'd go to bed early and I'd continue working on these things for a couple hours. And I had like 8 I had to do for all the people who were mailing these things to. And so I kept putting them up and putting them up. And she kept coming out and seeing this amazing detail. And I blew her mind because at 8 she couldn't realize, she didn't realize that paint could be painted on a rooftop to look like contoured snow, even though there is no contour. It was just painted into it, right? She got to see that you can become competitive, sort of, you know, make yourself excellent all by yourself. And then when people see these things, their minds blow, right? They're like, oh my God, where'd you get these? And you're like, we made them. And they're like, oh, wait a minute. Now, did you buy these completely done and then you put glitter on them? Like, no. These are wood color when we got them. Boom. Then all of a sudden, competitiveness becomes a wonderful, blissful thing. I think you feel me. We could beat up competitiveness from a million different angles, but I think those are the most accessible ways, the most digestible ways to pull it off. And always open to your comments. As I always say, if you made it this far, thanks for listening. MKUltraRadio.com. Everything's up there. Again, this came from a fan. Thank you, Matt, so much. Look forward to your next idea. For those of you who have ideas, comment below. Feel free to post on the Facebook. If you want to hide your correspondence with us in both fashions, Facebook has the messaging feature. And I believe YouTube does too, but I don't get too many of those. But you can correspond with us and we'll review. Again, I'm really trying to make sure that at least every other Deep Thoughts is one from me, one from you, one from me, one from you, that sort of thing. There's a lot of problems we need to fix in this planet, and I'm just all about the cause, you know, the rudimentary thoughts that either make us great or bad, right? But again, learn the rules that rule you. Take care of yourself and somebody else. Over now.